welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lendman. Today the topic again is Gaza. It's a very, very major story, and it's impossible to really understand what's going on through the major media. You'll get plenty of it on this program, and the wonderful guests that we bring on will absolutely explain what, in fact, is going on. I have two very, very distinguished guests today. My first could only stay for about 15 minutes ago. Her name is Phyllis Bennis. Phyllis has been on before. Phyllis is a noted activist, a Middle East expert, a UN expert, and she's written many books. She does policy papers. She writes many articles. And Phyllis, I hope I've got your three most recent books correctly. I'm honestly not sure in what order, but let me read them off very fast. And Ramsey, hang in there. I'll introduce you as well. I think I'll concentrate on Phyllis, and she has to go, and then you and I have the rest of the program. But Phyllis's recent books are Ending the Iraq War, a Primer, Understanding the U.S.-Iran Crisis, a Primer, and Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict, a Primer. Am I on target, Phyllis?
You're exactly right.
Oh, I think I missed it last time. So I did apologize, and I'm delighted. Ramsey, are you on as well?
Yes, I am.
Ramsey, hang on, because Phyllis has to leave. Let me delay my introduction of you, and I'll let Phyllis talk for about 15 minutes, then she has to go, and you and I will have the rest of the program. Phyllis, this is very serious business going on, and you wrote about it about 10 days ago, and so much has happened since. Give listeners your explanation of this crisis and what you make of it.
Well, I think the crisis has a number of origins, very few of which have anything to do with protecting Israeli civilians from so-called rocket fire. I think that what we have to look at the moment is the need for an immediate ceasefire, an immediate and unconditional ceasefire, and immediate access for humanitarian support for the Gazan population. The humanitarian crisis is at a breaking point. It's particularly since the ground invasion began a few days ago. The casualties have escalated massively, and the hospitals are absolutely unable to cope. The attack yesterday, deliberate attack by Israeli planes on a UN-run school that led to over 40 people being killed, many of them children. The adults that were there were primarily people who were fleeing other parts of the very crowded Gaza City, looking for shelter from the incessant bombing and obviously not finding it. But I think that as horrific as the conditions are, as the death toll continues to rise, the carnage everywhere, it is very important that we take the effort of stepping back to try and figure it out, to figure out what caused it, what can stop it, and how can we prevent it from ever happening again. I think we start with the question of the Israeli airstrikes and international law. There's a host of international laws that are being violated here, but we can start with the particular obligations that Israel has as an occupying power. You know, it's interesting, Steve, one of the things we hear very often from Israeli officials and Israeli spokespeople is that Israel is just defending its own population from these rockets. We should note that during the ceasefire, which lasted a good 5 months, for Israelis, it worked. The ceasefire worked. Nobody was killed. There were 14 rockets that were fired at various points during that 5 months. They didn't hit anything that caused any serious damage, and no one was killed.
Phyllis, let me interrupt you. That music means a commercial break is coming. Let's take that, and we'll come right back. Phyllis Bennis. Phyllis, let me just add one thing. I can't help but interject a little bit. During the months, 5 months or so, that Hamas unilaterally declared a ceasefire, not a single Israeli was killed. Whoever fired those rockets, they may not have been Hamas, and there weren't many. And my understanding is that over that period, 24 or more Gazans were killed by Israelis.
That's absolutely right. The ceasefire worked for Israelis far better than it did for Gazans, but it did work for Israelis. Since we don't have a lot of time, I wanted to just move to the question not only of the international law violations, which include questions of collective punishment, targeting civilians, the disproportionate nature of the attacks. But what's very important is the question of U.S. complicity. You know, the U.S. government is directly complicit in these violations, directly complicit by providing Israel with uncritical and unchallenged access to all of the most advanced weaponry that Israel is, in fact, using in this attack, in violation not only of international law, but also of U.S. law. The Arms Export Control Act prohibits the use of U.S.-provided arms for any purpose outside of a very narrowly defined kind of self-defense. Israel is clearly violating the Arms Export Control Act, and Congressman Dennis Kucinich and others are calling for an investigation of those violations. There's also indirect complicity in the way that the United States provides absolute protection to Israel in the United Nations, preventing Israel so far from being held accountable for its violations. The Security Council has been essentially stalled by a U.S. threatened veto. The statement that was issued by the Council last week was completely insufficient, essentially equated the Israeli assault without any reference to the violations of international law and without any reference to the fact that Israel remains the occupying power. Despite having pulled its settlers and soldiers out of Gazan territory, it remains in operative control of the entire Gaza Strip. It controls the borders. It controls access of goods and services. It controls whether people, whether it's patients, whether it's sick people, vulnerable people, get in or out of Gaza. It keeps journalists out. It controls the seas. It controls the airspace. So the notion that somehow when the settlers and soldiers were pulled out in 2005, that Gaza was somehow left to its own devices is simply not the case. So the question of U.S. complicity is very immediate, and I would urge listeners to go to the website of the U.S. Campaign to End Israeli Occupation, which is an easy one to remember. It's endtheoccupation.org, where there's a whole host of protests, a list of protests going on all across the country, new campaigns focusing on U.S. military aid to Israel, talking points for meeting with members of Congress, sign-on letters to go to the transition team for President-elect Obama, urging a statement that would condemn the Israeli attacks in Gaza and the horrific civilian toll of those attacks. So there's a great deal of work to be done.
Oh, indeed there is, Phyllis. Let me just say one thing. When you have to go, you just let me know, and you can stay till the next break.
Yeah, I've
or
got to go.
Or if it gets to the point where you have to run off for a meeting, then please
go to
just do.
Yeah.
I don't want to keep you any longer than possible.
Thank you.
Oh.
I'm at the UN now, so I look forward to being on your
UN.
Show again.
Have you got a couple more minutes?
Just 2 minutes then, yeah.
2 minutes. Well, then you take it and you add whatever else you think is important.
Well, the most important thing is for people to act. You know, I think there's a tendency watching these events on television, the images of the death and destruction is horrific, and many people are left just devastated by it and feeling that there's nothing we can do. But this is made possible by our tax money, paid for with our taxes, and it's our government, with or without our consent, that is making this possible. When Condoleezza Rice spoke here at the UN last night, I was watching her in the Security Council. She was angry. She was angry because her legacy is being destroyed. Her legacy that she thought she had overcome, her legacy of 2006 when she told the world during Israel's attack in Lebanon that we don't need a ceasefire yet, as if the world somehow needs more dead people before you can call for a ceasefire. She's doing the same thing now, and she's angry that she's going to go out of office with that legacy intact. And I think it's our job to overcome that legacy. The Bush administration has 2 more weeks in office, and it's our job to force them to stop this uncritical support for Israel that has been so much the heart of their foreign policy. Just last, I want to say one other thing, and that is that Barack Obama promised us not just that he would end the war in Iraq, but that he would change the mindset that led to that war. This war, Israel's current war in Gaza, is of the same mindset as the U.S. war in Iraq. It's of the mindset that says that every political problem can be answered with a military solution. It's the mindset that says that military occupation equals democracy. And it's a mindset that fails. And we need to remind President-elect Barack Obama, not condemn him that he hasn't done it yet, he's not president yet, but remind him of that commitment and remind him that changing the mindset that leads to war applies to all our foreign policies, including this one.
Oh, indeed, Phyllis. This is a very major piece of business. It has me obsessed and absolutely outraged, and I say that as a Jew, you as well.
Yeah.
This can't stand. The one thing that encourages me is the extent of mass world outrage. But I know you have to go.
I do.
Can
Thanks
we pick this up on another program?
Absolutely.
Oh, Phyllis, thank you so much.
Thank
I'll
you.
Let you run. Ramsey, are you with me?
I'm still with you, Steve.
Oh, I discovered the very last moment that Phyllis could only stay on for about 15 minutes. I didn't know that until my producer called and said, oh, yes, I'm getting Phyllis. She said she can only stay on a very short time, so I thought that was the best way to do it.
That's too bad, but she is still as eloquent as ever, even in a very small window of time.
Oh, she's an incredible person, the same way you are. I couldn't think of two better people to have on than you.
Thanks.
And, Ramsey, before I tell listeners, you've been on before, but I'll remind listeners of who you are and what you've done. But let me just tell you on air that I made contact with Jennifer Lowenstein, this wonderful woman who's also very much on this, teaches at the University of Wisconsin, and she's in Beirut right now, and she will come on a future program. We scheduled, oh, my goodness, I've got so much going on. I believe it's a week from today. No, she couldn't. No, 2 weeks from today, I believe she'll be on the 22nd.
She said it
wasn't good timing for her until after mid-January. So she'll come on, and we'll talk again about what's going on there. And, Ramsey, you and I know that this is not going away in a hurry. But let me explain to listeners who don't know you just who you are. You're a Palestinian-American. You were born in a Gaza refugee camp. You have to have friends, family, whatever, there going through this. Just a terrible, terrible thing. You host, you're the editor-in-chief of the Palestine Chronicle website, and I got your email that yesterday an Israeli group hacked the site. Are you still working to get it back up?
We're still working to get it back up. What we discovered so far is that the hacking happened from Israel, and it was a very calculated attack. It wasn't your usual hacking of the server, but rather they managed to break into our passwords and so forth, and they deleted all of our files, Steve. So we are devastated, and we are trying the best we can to get as much back of the website as we can.
Oh, my goodness. My goodness. Well, it proves a point. I sent you an email this morning. It proves a point, Ramsey. What you do is having an impact. Otherwise, why would they bother with you? This listeners should know this. This is what the Israeli government does. It murders innocent people. It does not want to let the word get out on what it's doing. Well, let me finish up on your background, Ramsey, and then I'll let you jump into it, too. You're also a former Al Jazeera producer. You've done so much writing, and I think your most recent book, you're working on a new one now that I look forward to having come out. But your most recent book is The Second Palestinian Intifada, A Chronicle of a People's Struggle. It's more important than ever now because Palestinians are calling for a third intifada. They need to get your book, read your book, and see what the second one was all about. We absolutely need something again. This should not and cannot be allowed to stand. Ramsey, your heart has to ache very greatly. Let me let you pick up and talk about what's happening.
Well, it's usually in times like this, we kind of resort to statistics and figures and numbers to try to, you know, describe the situation in Gaza or whatever other devastated area. But frankly, Steve, even mere words cannot even begin to convey what is going on. I mean, we know by now that there has been 680 killed in the last 12 days, and over 3,200 wounded, according to Al Jazeera and Palestinian medics. But what is really difficult to comprehend, aside from these numbers, is to try to actually visualize the situation in Gaza. This is not your casual, war where you have a superior military power attacking a weaker nation and devastating it and destroying its civilian buildings and killing a lot of people. This is a nation that has been besieged or under siege and imprisoned and caged, really, for years. They have been starved. They have been denied the basic necessities. They have been denied clean water. They have been denied electricity. They have been denied food and medicine. To the point that they had to dig many tunnels under the ground, and that is the only window to the world. But even that window to the world was hampered by the fact that many of these tunnels would be flushed out with water or with chemicals, and a lot of people would die as a result. And yet, after all of this, which many people, including UN Human Rights Envoy Richard Falk, described as genocidal, after all of this, we reach a point...
You hear the music going, Ramsey. We have to take another break for a commercial. Hold that thought, and we'll be right back.
Okay.
Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Ramsey Baroud. Ramsey, let me mention one thing that just struck me during the break. I don't know if anyone would want to hack me, but I do two things to have a record of everything that I have done, just a record of my articles. I have a daily off-site backup, an off-site hard drive backup, so everything I have daily gets recorded off-site. So if my building burned down or something and I lost everything, everything is there off-site and I can retrieve it all. And I also frequently burn disks. So I have everything on disk. Now, if my building burned down, the disk would go with it. But this is the way I have. You've got a lot more material because you add so much on a regular basis. I'm just doing it for the articles I write, just to have a reservoir in one place. I once had a hard drive go down on me, and thankfully I did not lose a great deal. But it was a terrible wake-up call, and I realized that I needed a backup, and I wanted it off-site in case anything went wrong where I live. So this is the way I do it. Oh, dear, I do hope you retrieve what you had and that turns out. But let me pick up where you left off.
So as I was saying, Steve, we are not dealing with a normal situation here of war. If people were, even if they anticipated an Israeli air and ground offensive, they could have done really nothing because there is very little money and there is very few things to buy in the first place. So they are underfed already. The kids in Gaza, according to many reports, including the World Bank, have been malnourished for many months. And under these extreme circumstances, Israel invites this extreme war on Gaza. And to try to visualize it better, when we think Gaza and Israel, we might actually also think that there are two entities of similar geographic size. The reality is Gaza is a 6 kilometer by 12 kilometer long, and is it's really more or less a fenced prison. One of those fences is the sea, and Israeli military boats are surrounding it, and the rest is fences and trenches and walls separating it from Egypt and Israel. So as a result, you have this panicking, frightened population really more or less running in circles. They have absolutely nowhere to flee, and they are being gunned down on a daily basis. Yesterday alone, 135 people got killed and over 200 people were wounded in the Israeli attack. Because I wouldn't even actually call it fighting. I wouldn't even call it war. Because in the case of war, we are talking about two armies of similar or comparable strength. We are talking about young men who are fighting and resisting with weapons that, some of these weapons they actually manufacture on their own. So this is a ridiculous war, and to actually listen to Condoleezza Rice yesterday, I could care less about her legacy. Talking to the United Nations, to the Security Council, saying that this is the Palestinians' fault, this is Hamas to blame for this, and Israel has the right to defend its citizens, which sounds like an unthreatening statement when you think about the Palestinians who are dying by the droves every day, that statement is completely baseless.
Randy, I was surprised that Phyllis said that Condoleezza is worried about her legacy. There is nothing that Israel does of a major nature that is not done collaboratively with Washington. And the evidence is very clear that this attack was planned at least 6 months ago. A major target, maybe the main target, was the civilian population. Obviously, the aim is to weaken Hamas, to bring them into submission, not to destroy Hamas. You can't destroy Hamas. I don't know that Israel even wants to destroy Hamas. They simply want to bring them into submission, like Fatah, so that they have a Abbas-type leadership in Gaza, the way there is in the West Bank, and Israel runs everything. And the people literally are just under the heel of an oppressive occupier and unable to resist. And Israel can enforce its will any which way it wants, which of course means no rights whatsoever for the Palestinians. And Hamas's greatest crime is the fact that they actually want to rule. They want to govern the nation, if you can call it that, that they won in a democratic election. They want to do that. They want to serve their people. They want to provide social services. And they're willing to recognize Israel as long as Israel grants them one thing. It almost sounds crazy, Ramsey.
I fully agree with you, Steve. I think this is a much bigger game than that of Israel doing what Israel does best, which is brutalizing Palestinians and its Arab neighbors. Yes, there is an element of that, a major element of that, in fact, but there is more to that. As we know, there has been, I wouldn't even call it a conspiracy, there has been really an open agreement that the democratically elected government of Hamas had to be toppled. And this agreement has been in the open, and it's been discussed in the news by European Union members, by the United States, in fact, by other Arab governments, such as Egypt, for example. And as a result, the state that has been imposed on Gaza would have not succeeded if it were not for the full collaboration of Egypt in this matter.
The democratically elected dictator of Egypt, Hosni Mubarak, yes, he very definitely is a partner in crime. Let's take a break, Ramsey, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Let me just take a moment and make an announcement. My co-host, editor of Global Research, Michelle Chosudowski, he does such extraordinary writing on so many topics, and he's giving a public lecture a week from today on January 14th in Montreal. He doesn't say on the website, but I suspect the talk will be recorded. Not everyone lives in the Montreal area. For those who do or could get to the talk, there's information about it on the website. It's free to the public. Anybody can come. It's at 7 in the evening. The address is listed. And I'm hoping that the talk will be recorded and then post it on Global Research. It's a vitally important topic. It's the other major topic of the day. And his subject is the global financial crisis. His subheading, the Great Depression of the 21st Century, and that's no joke. Michelle has written extraordinary stuff on this. He'll talk about it at length. And if it'll be in English, so if it's recorded and posted, it'll be in English for people to read. I think the site also posts in French, so French-speaking people can read it as well. The Q&A, he says, will be in French and English. Michelle is multilingual. I just wanted to mention that. Again, globalresearch.ca, you can get information on this, and then watch for the posting if it comes up a week from today. Ramsey, let's get back to Gaza. Again, it's a story. It's number one, it's a story that's not going away in a hurry. This was planned to last. The obvious analogy is to think of Lebanon 2006, 33 days of a rain of hell from the sky, from the ground, and I wrote about it back then, and it was a terrible story, and this is being inflicted on Gaza now. And when I spoke to you last week, I mentioned the possibility of cluster bombs being used. I haven't read anything about that, but I suspect they are, but I've read about other terror weapons being used. And you mentioned one horrific thing to me. If you know anything more about it, maybe you can discuss it a bit. You mentioned that not included in the death count as of, say, about a week ago, were possibly around 300 people that medical personnel called clinically dead, too far gone to survive. Have you any more information on that?
Well, because my sister is a doctor in the Khan Yunis area, which is a city in the south of the Gaza Strip, she constantly updates me on what is going on, and that number has already increased. It's a lot more than 300. Of course, we don't know the exact figures, simply because we also have so many people who are under the rubble right now, and Israel is not allowing the Palestinian medics to get there and to save their lives. Yesterday, I was listening to this man on Al Jazeera. He had Israeli troops basically brought him with his entire family and six other families from the neighborhood, and they put them together in one three-story house in Jabalia. And they ordered them not to leave. They said, we are doing this for your own safety, and we will get you out when the fighting is over. Well, they kept them in for one day and one night, no food, no electricity, no water, no access to a bathroom. And by the end of that one day and one night, they actually blew up the house with everybody inside. The man somehow managed to survive with one of his children. Eight members of his family perished in the house. That's the confirmed death from his side. But he says that at least there are 50 more people who are all the way under the rubble of the three-story house. So we're not only talking about the clinically dead, we are talking about the dead and wounded right now that is caught under the rubbles of their own homes and schools and hospitals, who are not being allowed any medical attention and are not being allowed burial as well.
This really is horrific. Targeting civilians, Ramsey, by the way, is a very, very old tactic. It seems to go on in all wars. And I mentioned this in an article I'm working on now, just taking the U.S. alone. You could go back, just say, to the World War II era. The U.S. Committed grievous war crimes against Japan. At the end of the war, while the Japanese were negotiating surrender with the Russians, in 1945, they were hopelessly defeated. They absolutely wanted the war to end, and I read the terms that General MacArthur provided in a 40-page document on exactly what they proposed. They basically proposed to do anything the victor wanted, and they only asked one thing in return: to retain their emperor in an honorable capacity. Roosevelt turned them down flat. Truman turned them down flat, and in the end, we let them keep their emperor. Truman turned them down because we wanted to do a few last dastardly things. We firebombed Tokyo, and literally burned the city to the ground at a time that most structures in Tokyo were wooden. So we dropped massive amounts of incendiaries, murdered 100,000 people in one night, Ramsey, in one night. And then we bombed Hiroshima and Nagasaki with nuclear weapons. And the idea behind doing this was to send a message to our next adversary, the Soviets, basically telling them that we're mean and nasty, and we're the meanest, toughest guy around. And we're not kidding. Here's what we did to the Japanese. Now we can do the same thing to you. So we murdered a few hundred thousand people gratuitously to send a message. The civilian lives simply didn't matter. We've done this many, many times. We did it in North Korea. We did it in Vietnam. We've done it in Iraq. We've done it in Afghanistan. And Israel has done it for six decades against the Palestinians, beginning with the so-called War of Independence that Alain Pape documented so brilliantly, his book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. And he was on my program once, and I reviewed his book a couple of years ago, I believe now. And he documented how he got hold of official Israeli documents. How you get hold of this stuff, I don't know. And it showed the unbelievable carnage that Israeli forces inflicted on Palestinians, either murdering or displacing around 800,000 people, and then creating the myth that they left on their own accord to avoid being harmed by the invading Arab armies. What a bunch of rubbish. Absolute concocted lie, plus wiping out 500-odd Palestinian villages, 11 urban neighborhoods, if I remember the number. I mean, it was amazing carnage. It would be very tough for them to top that. But Gaza, first that war, Ramsey, then the 67 war, and now Gaza, pretty outrageous.
And this, I think, takes us to the issue of the media. I mean, how can you create a myth in right now in the 21st century? This is not an easy thing to do. You could create a myth in 1948. There was no media access. You know, there were no war reporters all over the place, no people with digital cameras. And how do you create a myth under a situation like this where we have this kind of amazing technology that allows us to spread the news all over the world? And you do that by suppressing the media and by infiltrating the media of others. And, of course, by hacking other people's websites like mine. But the point is, Gaza is not just a prison for people inside Gaza. No one is allowed to go into Gaza, including international aid workers and the Red Cross, and etc., but also journalists. Reporters and journalists and cameramen are not allowed to go into Gaza. So all that we see from Gaza are the limited footage that comes from the already existing journalists there in Gaza, and they are mostly Gazans, and it's still horrific at that. But if you look at the U.S. media, you really get the impression, despite of the death toll of Palestinian that is more or less reported, you really get the impression that this is an equal war, and you get the impression that Israelis are just living a daily hell and a daily suffering because of the Palestinians, which is really not the exact truth there. That Israelis can come and go if they wish. They have places to run away to avoid whatever Palestinian rockets that are lobbed from Gaza. But the reality is Gazans do not have the same leverage. They die, and they are not even allowed to go to hospitals. And this is a major issue. I think it deserves a whole different show, just the Israeli control of myth and terminology and their stronghold over the media narrative. It's just incredibly important, I think.
Oh, absolutely, Ramsey. And, of course, the dominant media here, the corporate radio, the CBS, the CNNs, Fox, The Works, National Public Radio, Public Radio, they very much trumpet the Israeli lie. You know, poor Israel, fourth most powerful military in the world, merely acting in self-defense. I spotted, but I didn't read, an article on Haaretz that occasionally puts out some good material. I forget the writer, but the headline was something like, well, you know, what if Mexicans were firing rockets across the border into Texas or something? I mean, absolutely absurd. Taking an act of willful, premeditated aggression and turning it into an act of self-defense. And as Phyllis mentioned, this conflict has absolutely nothing to do with rockets. It was planned 6 months or so ago. There were no rockets coming, virtually no rockets. No Israelis were hurt. This was a willful, premeditated act of aggression to destroy the power of Hamas. Again, I don't think Israel cares if Hamas is around. You remember, Ramsey, in 1987 when Hamas became established, Israel supported Hamas as a counterweight to the PLO under Arafat.
That's correct, Steve. And I think what Israel really cares about, it doesn't care whether you're a secularist, a socialist, an Islamist, or a Martian. What they really care about is that you should not be a Palestinian with the will to resist, and you should not be the type of Palestinian that believes in certain constants and would adhere to those constants. What the difference between Hamas and others right now is that Hamas, that is a group that instilling what Palestinians refer to as a culture of resistance, meaning that we have basic rights and we are not willing to compromise on those rights. Israel believes it's a country with a brutal and strong military arm, and a country like this should not be challenged under no circumstances. In other words, Israel has the right to impose whatever it perceives as good for the Palestinians, and Palestinians have to sign. Well, Palestinians for 60 years have refused to do so, even though, Steve, once in a while, we have the type of Palestinian like Mahmoud Abbas who is willing to sign and who is willing to play the game by Israeli and American standards. Well, you have a Palestinian now who is saying, we will not, and we would rather die than to be humiliated and to be defeated. And this is the kind of mentality that Israel can neither comprehend nor accept.
I hope Hamas stays as resolute as Hezbollah did in Lebanon. Hezbollah really imposed a stinging defeat on the Israeli forces, the IDF, embarrassed Israel. Some people say that one of the motives behind this conflict is to make amends for being humiliated in Lebanon. I think there are bigger fish for Israel to fry, but they certainly don't want to be humiliated again. But I truly hope they will end up being humiliated and that Hamas will stand firm and not give up. You can't go head-to-head with the fourth most powerful military, but I hope they can wage a guerrilla action just like forces in Iraq have done against our occupiers and the Afghan fighters are doing right now and very effectively in Afghanistan. How else do you drive out an occupier? You make them feel enough pain for a long enough period of time, and finally they say, no more of this, let's get out.
Another thing that I would like to add to that, Steve, is that it's the will of the Gazans to fight. Again, Israelis are not getting it. In the first few days of the airstrikes on Gaza, they were dropping leaflets calling on the Gazans to rise and to overthrow the Hamas menace. They are really not getting it. They are not getting that this is a legitimately elected government and the people of Gaza, regardless of their ideological or religious background, in fact, are supportive of that government because they trust it, because they know it's not corrupt, and because they believe in its ability to speak on their behalf much more fairly than Fatah did. This is not the kind of scenario where you are going to have the people rise and overthrow the government the same way they rose in the time of the Iraq War, or at least what we were told. But the fact is, this is not going to happen in Gaza. This is not just about the guerrilla warfare in Gaza. It's about the people of Gaza. The people of Gaza are the resistance of Gaza, the ordinary people of Gaza. You ask every person who lost a loved one in the last 2 weeks, and they will tell you, I would do it again if I know that this is going in for Palestine, if this is going to be a sacrifice for for the freedom of the collective. This is the Gaza mentality. This is the Palestinian mentality. And Israel thinks it's all about throwing leaflets and people would just rise and overthrow the government and hand the keys of the city to the Israeli invaders. And it's just not going to happen.
Well, it's not going to happen at all. Can I mention one other thing, too?
Yes, please.
There is one leader and one world leader and only one that I'm aware of that has stood up to what Israel did, and that's Hugo Chavez. Did you see what he did, Ramsey?
Absolutely. He was extremely proud of Chavez.
Oh, incredible. He referred to the Israeli Holocaust against the Palestinians, called it genocidal, and he expelled the Israeli ambassador and the diplomatic team that he had with him. I think he did that yesterday. He's the only one who's taken a stand. He is one glorious human being. We need to salute Hugo Chavez. One more black mark against him from Washington, but he's a pretty courageous guy to stand up, and he didn't mince words. He called this thing what it is, and we probably will hear more from him about this.
Absolutely, all respect and thanks from the people of Gaza to Chavez and to the people of Venezuela for their honorable stance in these hard times. Another person that I maybe has not gone as far as Chavez has, I think, is Erdogan of Turkey, who has at least taken a much stronger stance against the Israeli genocide in Gaza, at least much stronger than many of the weaseling Arab rulers of the Middle East. He called the genocide in Gaza a black spot in the history of the humanity, and it's a shame that it's continuing under the watchful eyes of everyone. Hopefully Turkey would go as far as Chavez has, but indeed what Chavez has done is very honorable, and he deserves all respect for that.
Ramsey, let's take another break, and we'll come back, and we'll finish up the hour. Ramsey, can I read you something inspiring? I have a Mexican friend who sends me material from time to time, and she sent me a wonderful email. She's involved in an organization there. She's an activist on Mexican issues, and she sent me an email that she sent out to a lot of people, and it's to our dear brothers and sisters of Palestine and Gaza. She mentions a couple of names, people I guess she knows, and she quoted the former great German playwright and poet, Bertolt Brecht, and four lines. Let me read you these lines. From him, he wrote this decades ago. He wrote that there are men who fight for one day and are good. There are men who fight for 1 month and are better. There are men who fight for 1 year and are much better. But there are those who fight all their life. Those are the indispensable ones. I think those are the Palestinians we're talking about now.
And indeed, Steve, they have been fighting all of their lives. I mean, the children of who are dying in Gaza, they are the descendants of the same children who were driven from their homes and villages in Palestine, in historic Palestine, in 1947 and 1948, and were sent to exile and refugee camps and concentration camps, really. And they were married and they had children and their children had children and these are the children of the descendants of the original refugees who are dying in Gaza. So, and yet they continue to fight. I call my family back in Gaza and I ask about everyone, of course, and it's not easy to get hold of everyone. I listened to Al Jazeera yesterday and they said that the Baroud family was blown up in my refugee camp, original refugee camp.
Oh,
I don't know what Baroud family that is. I mean, we have various Baroud family branches in the Gaza Strip, so I really don't know if they are immediate relatives or not. So I've been trying to get hold of people, but I can't. But the other thing, Steve, I wanted to say is that some of the children who were children when I left Palestine over 15 years ago, they are now in the resistance or journalists or whatever. They are all taking their part in defending Gaza and standing up for Gaza. And they and here's what is so odd, Steve, or what some people might think is odd. I call Gaza because I get so depressed by the news, and yet it's the people of Gaza who seem to be upbeat, and they tell you, do not. As long as we are standing and as long as we are fighting, there is absolutely nothing to be depressed about.
Ramsey, I repeat for my listeners, they're not militants. They're not terrorists. These are very courageous freedom fighters. They want their freedom just like everybody does. And they deserve it. They've waited so long. They deserve it. We have to support them.
We do.
Ramsey?
Yes, I'm still here. Absolutely, Steve. We do. They deserve our support. And the question I think we should finish with is how do we support them? We certainly do not support them just by simply sympathizing with them. We have to understand that we live more or less in a democracy that hasn't yet been completely hijacked. There is still an element of self-expression in this country that is open. There is still freedom of expression that would allow us to speak out, that would allow us to contact our representatives, our congresspeople, our media, to ask them to be fair, to tell them where we stand exactly on this issue, lest they haven't already been aware of the fact that
we're out of time. They're going to cut us off. We need to join the mass world outrage and let our voices be among theirs. I'm encouraged by how much there is. Ramsey, will you come back and we can pick this up again?
Of course, Steve, I will. Thank you so much for
Ramsey,
having me.
Ramsey, thank you so very much. We're going to continue to follow Gaza on program after program. We're not going to let them get away with this.
Absolutely.
We support
not.
The rights of all people. Thank you, Ramsey.
Thank you.
We'll be back on Friday with another live.